I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Normal People? Edition. It's Wednesday, May 13th, 2020. On today's show, Normal People is the BBC Hulu adaptation of the Sally Rooney novel. It tells the story of a star-crossed, class-inflected love affair between two young, aspiring creatives coming of age in contemporary Ireland. And then John Krasinski, he of the Quiet Place movies, The Office, and Jack Ryan, has created a quarantine talk show from his home. It's called Some Good News, and you can find it on YouTube. And finally, Dana's turn has come around again. And how would you know that? The comfort movie pick this week features a murderous psychopath. We discuss the Nicholas Ray noir classic In a Lonely Place, which I've wanted to see forever. Dana Stevens, thank you for finally goading me into watching it. Dana is the film critic for Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hello.
Please tell me that you're safe and sound in Brooklyn, New York.
I can't complain, or rather I can, but will not on the air.
Yeah, I know. And Julia Turner joins us from Los Angeles. She's the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And I take it you're hanging in there, I hope.
As well as can be.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Marianne is a rich girl from an ice-cold, effed-up family. She's brilliant, but troubled and socially ostracized at school to the point of being universally reviled. Connell is the school's beloved, if somewhat inscrutable, star athlete, star student. He's really kind of an impossible combination. He's popular, talented, unassuming. He's also the son of Marianne's family's housekeeper. The two begin a secret love affair, one that hopelessly confuses the pecking order of the school, where he's a demigod and she's the reviled scapegoat. Up with the pecking order of the wider world, i.e. the social class structure of contemporary Ireland, by which her future is all but assured and his, but for some very high test scores, would already be foreclosed. The novel was a rare thing indeed. It was a tragicomedy of manners that, along with her other novel, Conversations with Friends, made Sally Rooney an international literary darling. And dare I say it, kind of voice of the millennial generation, possibly. The adaptation was substantially co-written by Rooney herself. It stars Daisy Edgar-Jones as Marianne and Paul Mescal as Connell. Let's listen to a clip.
You were saying the other day that you like me. By the photocopier, you said it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you mean like as a friend or what?
No. Not just as a friend.
Yeah, I thought that might be implied. I just wasn't sure. See, I'm just a little confused about what I feel. I think it'd be awkward in school if something happened with us.
No one would have to know.
Dana, let me start with you. We talked about the book on the show. What'd you make of this adaptation?
I mean, I think that I would substantially say I have the same response as I do to the book, which maybe speaks to how faithful this adaptation actually is. Sally Rooney did write the first six episodes of the show. And there's almost not a story beat from the novel that isn't in there. So if you like the extreme, it's been called kind of emotional pointillism of the novel, then you will like this adaptation too. I think if you went into this adaptation without having read the novel, you might think, why am I spending 6 hours digging into every single detail of this interesting and at times touching but not incredibly unusual relationship between two ordinary people? But to me, that's sort of where the appeal comes from. If it weren't for the casting and the chemistry between the two leads, obviously a show that is all about, you know, love and sex and attraction and repulsion between two young people would only repel viewers and not attract them. And they found just two really great actors for these roles who, to me, really fulfilled how I pictured the characters in my mind from the book, with the exception, and I'm afraid you have to make this exception for almost every TV series and movie in history, is that the Marianne character is too good-looking. Daisy Edgar Jones, who plays her, is an incredible, dazzling beauty. There's no one who would not think she's beautiful, and the first whole third or so of the book and show revolve around the idea that she's this kind of homely outcast at the school. I mean, she is in part an outcast because she's arrogant and a snob and considers herself better than everyone in this small Irish town, and that comes across in the adaptation. But there's also just this recurring thing about, oh, the ugly, flat-chested Marianne that we're all going to mock, and she's just as much of a knockout as all the other girls in the school. So if you could make allowances for that glitch, I think their relationship is super well-rendered. And this doesn't have the problem that so many of these long streaming series do of feeling padded to me, even though it is a 12-part adaptation of a book. And maybe that's because each segment is only half an hour, which for a drama is an unusual length and feels somehow right for this one. Because of that pointillism, maybe, because there's just a very slight change in their relationship in every show.
Interesting. Julia, what about you? How did this build upon or deepen or change your feelings about Rooney, and what do you make of it as a TV watching experience?
I actually found it very different from the book as an experience, but smartly made and an interesting complement to the book. I thought Willa Paskin made this point really smartly in her review, which is in the book they have a lot of sex, but you're hearing about what they're thinking, and it's about kind of the complicated emotions around a sexual relationship. And in the show, you just watch them have a lot of sex. Like, there's just a lot of sex, and the sex isn't exploitative, and it's, you know, kind of interestingly realistically rendered, but it's very serious sex. Like, it's not, I don't know, funny or casual, or it's very solemn in a way that is, you know, I just a different way of experiencing these characters and their plot lines. I also think the way that, I mean, there is one major deviation in how the kind of plot points of the book are unfurled in the show, which is that Marianne's household is kind of icy and abusive, and that is rendered with a very soft touch. You get that it's kind of emotionally cold and distant in the world of the TV show, but you know, I'm five episodes in, and the kind of sense of physical violence is only briefly mentioned, and mentioned as part of Marianne's history, not part of her present. And that becomes such an important part of her relationships as they unfold over time, and her relationship with Connell, that it seems odd to leave that out, and also makes her persona in this small town where she's growing up, like, kind of inexplicable. Like, she doesn't seem, yeah, she's like arrogant and she puts people down and she's a little bit too lacerating with a burn, but she's gorgeous and her clothes are too nice. Like, she's extremely fashionable in a way that rich girls are and can be, but in a way that is not, like, she's gawky and doesn't shave her legs and is kind of got rougher edges in the book, and she's such a, like, serene little ballerina in the show, that took some of the believability off of the ugly ducklingitude. But my favorite parts of the show, I mean, the book we praised for kind of bringing structural class consciousness into and at odds with personal affiliation and kind of exploring what kind of relationship you can have in a world full of economic structures and tensions. And I really thought the show does a good job highlighting those in some of those ways. I mean, maybe that's the point of her rich girl clothes. And I really, really loved the scene where the episode where Connell first arrives at Trinity and is just so at sea and alienated in this world of kind of posh and polished students. So I didn't dislike it, but I didn't like it as much as the book. And I think it's doing something interestingly different from the book. And the fact that Rooney's intelligence is animating it is you know, makes it, I think, worth watching and worth pursuing. But I don't think it's nearly as good as the book. I will also say the music is dreadful. Like, did you not find the musical cues so distracting? Like,
way too on the nose.
The sex music is very swoony, and then every episode closes with some kind of breathy singer-songwriter song that probably I would like on a Spotify playlist, but like in which the main lyric that starts the whatever clip they're using is like, feeling she just had strum strum. I am describing it strum strum. Like, too, it's so literal. Yeah. Ugh,
it's Irish really people having sex.
Steve, what did you make of it?
I will admit to having watched all of it and been captivated and quite moved by it, but with plenty of, I wouldn't call them reservations. I loved it, but a lot of thoughts. So I, you know, really admire Sally Rooney, but not uncritically. And I thought Normal People suffered from the Connell character being slightly hard to believe. He's kind of the depresso lug dream jock equivalent of the manic pixie dream girl. You know, there's, you know, this impossible combination of him being, you know, a brilliant athlete, completely not arrogant, but also a brilliant student, but not just, you know, I mean, you know, he's not just a student, you know, he turns out to have remarkable, you know, literary sensitivities.
Right.
I wasn't sure that such a person really exists, but the odd thing here is that that kind of flipped for me, which is, I think they're both absolutely amazing. I think this is the launching of two stars. I think Paul Mescal is so wonderful as this guy. And all of a sudden you see and feel the depth of his depression, shyness, and confusion, and how those three things really mix and create a kind of heaviness and reserve in him that's very human and explains a lot of the action of the drama, too. It's moments of working class humility where, for example, he just can't cough up a request to spend a month or two at her house over the summer, you know, because some summer job he had dried up and he can't make his rent. You know, that sinks the whole relationship. But that's like in that performance, you see that as an expression of working class pride that's very believable. And I think it hit me again watching this, how much of the action of this is about, yes, whether he can transcend his social class roots. It's also about the brilliant insight that the pecking order of high school, in a weird way, you are in this bubble that blissfully keeps the actual pecking order of the world at bay, i.e. social class. But that also has its cruelties as well. And so, you know, as an adult, you have intelligently equivocal feelings about that. And the fact that she's at the very, very bottom of that pecking order in high school, and you know, in some sense, that that's not lasting because she comes from this wealthy family. So his drama is a social class drama in some sense. Like, will he find, you know, confidence in his own creative abilities as someone who comes from a world where that generally is not prized? And he's going to leave these mates behind, these people who've denigrated her in high school. But her drama is a very different one. The question attending her character is, can she overcome her association of abuse and cruelty and coldness from love in a way? I mean, she is damaged. That's why the book kind of works, right? This person, you know, later on in the book, I don't want to give anything away for those who haven't read it or, you know, planning to see it, haven't seen it yet, but it's like she has a really fucked up attitude towards love and sex where she can't quite fully dissociate them from humiliation in a way. And what I think Rooney did so fucking brilliantly, and it really comes out in the show, is because of this weird accident of fate whereby this utterly decent boy is the son of her mother's housekeeper, and he's sufficiently socially ashamed of the fact that he's sleeping with her, she can kind of have a denigrating relationship in its secrecy, but with an absolutely, utterly decent human being. And so the question is, well, how is that going to play out? You know, I mean, that scene, Dana, I mean, I remember it was perhaps the scene I remembered most vividly from the book, because his mother, the housekeeper, is so beautifully drawn as a character, and it makes him believable as an utterly decent kid because he was raised by a single mother, single working class mother, who is clearly like a fucking rock, right? Like the fucking paragon of decency. and is drawn very believably as that. And there's a moment when she realizes her son is fucking this girl in secret. And she knows who this girl is at the school and why her son is doing this. And she pulls the car over and she fucking lights into him. She just says, she basically says, I'm ashamed of you in this moment, right? And what you're watching is the making of a decent human being, right? A decent man in some sense. It's like, you've really disappointed me by doing this. And she gets out of the car. And it seems to me that's where the stakes of this become quite powerful.
And that is a great scene in the show as well. She mentioned Sarah Green, who plays the mother, Lorraine, is a great character. Really, I think in the book too, the mother is the only fully drawn character that isn't one of the two leads, and she's fantastic in it. There's a great line at one point where she's writing him years later still about this, you know, the fact that he blew off Marianne in high school, and he says, why are you still bothering me about this stupid teenage mistake? And she says, you are my stupid teenage mistake, and you understand why, you know, she's a single mother and so young, you know, that she clearly had him when she was not much older than when her teenage son started all this nonsense.
All right. Well, it's the show's Normal People. It's about 12 episodes of varying lengths on can be found on Hulu. BBC was behind it, based on the Sally Rooney novel. Check it out. Talk to us about it. Let's move on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right, before we go any further, let's talk business. Dana, what do you have?
Well, we have a few things in business today. For one thing, in Slate Plus, we are going to be talking to dear friend of the podcast and former Slate music critic Jody Rosen, now from the New York Times Magazine, about Little Richard. This was actually, I think, Jody's idea. He wanted to dive bomb and have a segment about Little Richard, who passed away last week, and just talk a bit about what a huge influence, and in too many ways an under-acknowledged and forgotten influence, Little Richard is on the history of rock and roll and of American music. So that will be our Slate Plus segment. And as always, of course, if you want to hear those extra segments and to get our podcast ad-free, as well as all the other Slate podcasts, you can sign up for Slate Plus, our membership program. As we've been talking about for the last couple of episodes, the current pandemic situation has really caused a financial crunch in publishing in general, and certainly at Slate. And that's why, sadly, we have to come to you now every 2 weeks for a while. But if you want to help turn that around, it is in your power. You can sign up for Slate Plus at slate.com/culture plus. Again, that's slate.com/culture plus. And for those of you who do subscribe, thank you. We love you. And the only other piece of business, Steve, is that I believe you have your comfort movie picked out for 2 weeks from now. We've been announcing these in advance, so listeners have a chance to watch them as homework if they want to. What are you going to watch?
I think this week I'm going to go with a movie. I don't know that I've seen it since either it came out or, you know, in the 2 years period after it came out, in the video window, release window, but the Soderbergh movie Out of Sight, big kind of comeback picture for him. It's the one that set him up, I think, to have this kind of glorious second part of his career that he has had. Stars George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez, and it's just saucy, sexy, fun, based on Elmore Leonard. Terrific picture, as I recall, and I'd love to rewatch it with you guys.
Oh, yay. Maybe my very favorite Soderbergh. I'm so excited to rewatch that with you. That sounds like a blast. All right. Out of Sight, 1998, Steven Soderbergh. I'm sure it is available on practically every streaming platform because it's a beloved classic. And we will be talking about it in 2 weeks. Oh, wait, before we close down the business, there is one more piece of homework that we have to assign if people are interested. We thought that as a way to take advantage of this new biweekly format, we would start to try to do some bigger things. For example, I read all of In a Lonely Place, Steve, because of you, just to sort of have some background for the movie and how different the book and the movie are for this week. And what we would now like to do is read a big, long book together about the 1918 flu pandemic. This is supposedly one of the best histories of that pandemic, which, for obvious reasons, is fascinating to learn about now, but would be in any historical time. It's called The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History. It's by John M. Barry, And warning, it is 555 pages long. And for that reason, we're not exactly sure when we're going to do it on the show, but I wanted to throw it out there now as an assignment. If people want to get that book, it's on Kindle, it's in audiobook form. You can get it from your local bookseller, hardback, paperback, etc. It's been out for a few years now. And as soon as we can all manage to cram that book into our eyeballs, we want to talk about it and have a big segment on the influenza pandemic of 1918 and what that makes us think about our own time. So again, John N. Barry's The Great Influenza is going to be our book club pick. And I would say probably sometime in the next few weeks, depending on our reading capacity, we'll be discussing it on the show.
John Krasinski is the supremely likable guy actor who first broke onto stardom with the sitcom The Office. He's since vaulted onto superstardom with Jack Ryan and his writing and helming of the Quiet Place franchise. Like the rest of us, he's trapped indoors. So he started Some Good News, a nice guy twist on the Weekend Update format. It's a dad jokey and earnest faux news show. It's comprised of Zoom cameos mixing ordinary folks like you and me with celebrities like Martha Stewart and David Chang and Lin-Manuel Miranda and fill in the blank. Steven Spielberg, I think, is in there. It's filled with tear-jerking good news items from around a world which is coping with COVID quarantine. Let's listen to a clip.
From Washington, D.C. all the way to Spain, Chef Jose Andres hasn't decided to do something. He's decided to do the thing. Setting up kitchens anywhere from inside churches to inside National Stadium, his goal is a simple one. Feed as many people as possible. From frontline workers to the elderly, from the homeless to his fellow furloughed service workers, just this week, Jose and his team have served over 3 million meals.
Julia, let me start with you. What do you make of Mr. Krasinski and his YouTube show?
Well, I had heard about this phenomenon, but had not been watching it along the way. And I did something that is probably not advisable, which is watch like 7 of these in a row at once in one go. And the thing I found most remarkable about them to start with is just how abruptly our reality has changed. This may sound obvious, but the difference in tone and what seemed reasonable to say in week one from what seems reasonable to say in week 3 or 5 or 7 is really striking. And I found myself considering these texts as like primary source historical documents of a very weird moment in history rather than seeing them as entertainment. Like they felt instantaneously like little bits of history. In the first week, he's, you know, highlighting some of the things that have now become familiar. People cheering for healthcare workers in the evenings and virtual birthday parties through cars and people trying to express love and solidarity to each other from behind glass partitions and, you know, all of the kind of flotsam of little springs of hope that have popped up in response to this very unusual circumstance. And so watching it all at once rather than being comforting was actually sort of misery inducing because, you know, if you're just kind of half listening to old episodes of The Good Wife, say, hypothetically, or even transfixedly watching, you know, Irish sexpots have sex or Humphrey Bogart glower, you can be transported away. But this is the kind of entertainment where you're like, we are in a pandemic and things are weird, but maybe sometimes people are nice also, which is good to remember. And he does a good job making you remember it. But I can't say I found it like very reassuring. The other thing I'm curious about is sort of why is this what Krasinski is doing? Like he's essentially making an evening show or a late night show that's based on an evening news show and aping the rhythms of everything from The Daily Show to Colbert to Weekend Update, you know, to sort of Fallon or Kimmel kind of doing stunts and sketches with celebrities. And the ambition level gets kind of astronomically bigger week by week. Like, you know, in week one, he's like, let me call up Steve Carell and reminisce about The Office. And then in week two, he's like, let me get some nurses from Boston and put them in a duck boat and take them to Fenway and introduce them to David Ortiz and have them run the bases. And, you know, it he levels up aggressively and it's entertaining to watch, but why isn't he just like making sourdough like the rest of us? Like the fundamental mystery of this being his ambition is what is most fascinating to me about the show.
Right. And yet that ambition is combined with this aggressively homemade aesthetic that the show has, right? Like the logo is a apparent crayon drawing by his two daughters saying SGN, some good news. He makes it very clear that he's, you know, sitting at a desk in broad daylight, even though he's kind of aping an evening show host. And he's sweet enough and charming enough, and you want things to go well for him and Emily Blunt in their lives, that this show is agreeable to watch. But to me, it's missing the element that would make him into, you know, a Jon Stewart or a Johnny Carson or someone who you're sort of comforted by the return to their desk and their world and the things that they tell you to look at. And I mean, I guess that would just be a little bit of spice to go with the sugar. Obviously, a show called Some Good News is not going to be ranting and raving about how awful and really at times hopeless feeling the situation that we're in is. But as he's contacting these essential workers and thanking them, I mean, there needs to be, I think, some sense of how deep and how dark the stakes are of the things right. that they're helping with. And that seems to be something that shows is walling out, in part maybe to be family friendly, you know, right. in part to keep this world of Some Good News all good. But he has, for example, Jon Stewart as a guest on one episode. I think it was the second to last episode that Stewart comes on. And I just really got a sense of, for me, the actual comfort that Jon Stewart extended to me during the Bush administration, the reason that I did look forward to seeing his show at night, you know, obviously was not because it contained good news. It was because there was someone who was telling the truth about how messed up everything was.
Right. You know, obviously, John Krasinski is a brilliant human being. He is trying to do something in good faith that I admire. But as lovely as he is and as sweet as the intent behind this show is, it can't shut out in my mind the really tragic aspect of this, which is that this thing coincided with the presidency of Donald Trump, i.e. the least competent, least compassionate human being who's ever held the office happened to have it at just the moment we got our once in a 100-year pandemic. And the effects of this disease are going to be grotesquely maldistributed among the haves and the have-nots of American society. So it also comes at the end of a 30-year period of massively maldistributing life opportunities. It's like, I can't turn that off and just watch feel-good stories for 20 minutes, midwife though they may be, by the most pleasant man in show business. He is really likable. I say that without an ounce of you know, shit-eating irony at all. But it just doesn't, you know, I would say, Julia, for me, this pandemic has been an excuse to completely shut out celebrity culture and completely shut out the sort of cyborg hybrid existence that we live vis-a-vis social media, and to do one of two things: to really concentrate solely on the nuclear unit and have my reality at last be face-to-face fully in a way that I think a part of me dreams it ought to be and, you know, should be. And to try to reckon with the, you know, really awful moral implications of how a disease hits a human society. But nowhere in that does there fall a desire to have Martha Stewart beam into a Zoom chat in order to make me feel as though I'm kind of part of her universe when everything in my experience indicates to me that I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually kind of extraordinary how well the celebrity cameos are pulled off in this. Like, everybody's game, and he's definitely coming up with better things for them to do, you know, than sing to us.
You know what I think might save this show, if I could give notes to John Krasinski, because I do admire the effort, and it's I mean, part of my answer to your question, Julia, why is he doing this now as opposed to just sourdough, is like, it's something to do, you know. It feels to me like it's a creative endeavor that means something to him. And so even if it's not something I'll continue watching, I respect that. But I think it should be shorter. I think it should be one good thing. It should be like a 10 to 15 minute show that just covers one person in a little bit more depth and doesn't try quite so hard to have all the trappings of a regular talk show. I think I would be more likely to return to it that way, without, and I wouldn't be asking it to betray its essence and become darker than he wants it to be.
So, Julia, we didn't just randomly decide to talk about this. I mean, this thing got pretty big pretty quick, right? It's popular. It's out there. It's getting talked about.
Yeah, I mean, it's first episode had 17 million views, and so it kind of was this instant sensation. And then subsequent episode had 12, and then since then they've been hovering. A couple of them have hit around 6 million. Some of them are around 3 million. You know, so it's sort of like the general attention economy. I mean, I think if you probably look at the traffic of Slate or the LA Times or anything making stuff, like the kind of intense, I can't possibly think about anything except for the fact that this is what life is now, of the first few weeks, abates into a kind of more generalized interest in the situation. So it's a big hit that remains a big hit, but its audience pattern seems to be following the general audience pattern of the moment rather than kind of constantly accelerating, even as I think he's really raising the stakes in terms of what the big stunt is in each episode.
All righty. Well, it's called Some Good News. It's on YouTube. Check it out. Let us know what you thought of it. All right, moving on.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
In a Lonely Place is the 1950 noir classic from director Nicholas Ray. I think he's best known for Rebel Without a Cause. This one stars Humphrey Bogart as Dixon Steele, a brilliant if temperamental screenwriter on a losing streak. He's been asked to adapt a novel he feels nothing but scorn for, so much so he hasn't even bothered to read it. So in a fit of lazy inspiration, he asks a hat check girl who has read it to come over to his house, his apartment with him, and explain the book to him. It's late at night. His motives are, to say the least, pretty mixed. And her performance only fills him with more contempt, more self-loathing, and more writer's block. Later that night, after she's left his apartment, the girl is found dead, tossed out of a moving car like, as the screenplay says, like a cigarette butt. Dixon's only alibi is his beautiful new neighbor, Laurel Gray, played by Gloria Graham. His only alibi is her, because she has caught him staring up at her across the courtyard of their mission-style apartment building right around the time of the murder. The two of them do hook up, but it's under the hovering gaze of the cops and under the suspicion that Dixon may be the remorseless psychopath that they claim he is, i.e. the murderer. Let's listen to a clip.
You know, you're out of your mind. How could anybody like a face like this? Look at it.
I said I liked it. I didn't say I wanted to kiss it.
No, you're a quitter. A get out before you get hurt type.
Is that bad?
Well, I suppose you save yourself a lot of trouble that way.
I do. I think twice before I get into something.
You're getting into something right now.
No, I'm not. I've only thought about it once.
You a fast thinker?
Not right now. I didn't get much sleep last night. A neighbor kept me awake.
Well, go ahead and get some sleep and we'll have dinner together tonight.
We'll have dinner tonight, but not together.
Dana, I am very eager to talk about this movie with you. But first, I have to ask, what is it about you that you confuse being comforted with being morally nauseated?
I didn't realize the through line between my two comfort picks so far, The Talented Mr. Ripley and this, until you pointed it out. I promise for my next comfort pick, and I love lots of movies like this, I will pick something with absolutely no conflict whatsoever. It's just about lying on soft cushions and eating bonbons. But could either of you resist this movie? I mean, what the comfort in this movie to me comes from just the utter gem-like perfection of its craft. I've seen it so many times now, and every single time I can't remember which scene succeeds which in the way that happens when you're truly entranced by a story, right? I can't predict any of the story beats. I'm completely shocked and surprised by the ending, and which is not just the ending, but, you know, as you say, the suspense throughout the entire story as to whether or not Bogart is the murderer, and the love story. I mean, it's just, well, we'll get into a little bit what a twisted love story it is and how hard it is to root for this couple. But at the same time, don't you root for them? How can you not love Laurel Gray and Dixon Steele together? They're one of the great film noir Hollywood couples.
Mm. I mean, because he's an abusive weirdo.
But don't you think, I mean, it's odd that we're talking about this in the same week as Normal People, right? Which is about this relationship that has, at least on one side, a kind of masochistic strain. I mean, I think that this movie, in a way that probably Nicholas Ray could not even have been aware of at the time, is also a movie about what it was to be a woman, in particular, a sort of Hollywood, not quite a star, right? She's an aspiring star, Gloria Graham's character, but to be this object of female beauty in this very dangerous and sordid, really corrupt Hollywood environment. And Gloria Graham was married to Nicholas Ray, and they actually split up during or right before the shooting of this film. So it was a very tempestuous set. She was forced by the producer to sign a contract, a clause in her contract that essentially said, while I'm on set, Nicholas Ray can tell me to do anything he wants. And if you read the language and how incredibly controlling it is, it really starts to border on being abusive and frightening in the way that the Bogart character is sketched to be.
Didn't they later break up because she was found in bed with his 13-year-old son as well?
Oh, she did her homework. Like
he doesn't seem like the only person who's maybe crossing some lines.
No. I mean, both of them, both Nicholas Ray and Gloria Graham were such messed up individuals, and he married four times. But yes, she did, in fact, go to bed with his son, who was only 13 at the time. That happened 2 years after this movie came out, though. So they separated during this movie and divorced definitively when that happened. And she later married that teenager when he was a bit older, and they stayed married for 4 or 5 years. So yeah, there's crazy, crazy backstory to the lives of both Nicholas Ray and Gloria Graham.
Holy moly, I did not know that story. So I just a couple quick things, but before Julia, we bump it back to you, is that I didn't realize until I was browsing some internet materials that this movie is part of a trio of great acidic Hollywood satires that came out the same year. So there's In a Lonely Place, which was a bit of a bomb when it came out, especially next to Sunset Boulevard and All About Eve. So really three of the great movies about the movie making colony and about what's twisted about it came out within a period of months of one another. Just incredible. I love this movie. It's you know, if you're a Bogart fan as I am, a Nicholas Ray fan, it's just too delicious. I'm a fan of the book, and what there is something so meta and I believe totally self-conscious and precise going on here, which is that the entire action of the movie proceeds from the fact that he is supposed to be doing something that he's not doing. He is supposed to be adapting a book into a screenplay. This is a movie that is adapted from a book. And the question is asked explicitly in the course of the movie of the Bogart character, is he going to stick to the book? They've given him this schlock book. He doesn't want to do it. He understands before he's even cracked the book that it's a piece of crap. Middlebrow dreck. He's too much of a snob to do it. Bogart himself was a huge snob, an Andover boy who hated the fact that he'd become an actor. He brought all of his ambivalence and spite to the role of this guy. And as a viewer, you're asking, is a Hollywood movie going to stick close to the Dorothy Hughes book? What are they going to do in this adaptation? They change quite a bit, but are they going to stick to its essential moral queasiness? I mean, it's kind of ghastliness. The book is really ghastly. It is among the darker books I've ever read. But Julia, without giving anything away, for anyone who knows the book, the suspense and the meta aspect of this film are bound up completely in one another, because essentially you're asking the question that the heroine is asking, which is, am I going to end up with a psychopath?
Right. One thing that's interesting about the movie is that it reads to me, I mean, yes, it's ostensibly about Hollywood and there's great Hollywood types in it, but to me, it seems much less interested in Hollywood and its mechanisms than Sunset Boulevard or All About Eve or about performance and fame and acting. It seems really just much more about mysterious violence simmering within men. And it's set, you know, post-war, and it struck me as being kind of about that. Am I universalizing it too much? Like, obviously, the idea is that Dix is like a crazy, is just like, he's a weirdo. He's not wired right. You know, there's a sense that he's an outlier, and that he's not reacclimating to society in the way that, you know, his war buddy, the cop, has with his charming wife and their charming seaside cottage. But it really feels to me like it's much more about that. Like, we sent, you know, all the men went away for 5 years to be killers, and now they're just back at home.
Yeah, the movie's explicit about that. It's subtle, but it's explicit. There's a moment that I think it's the agent character says he hasn't written anything decent since before the war. And it's 1950, assuming that the movie is set at the time it was made. So, you know, there's been this 5-year period that this traumatized veteran has been simmering away, failing as a screenwriter. And so that all of that is in there.
I mean, the movie has it both ways, because it's even though it suggested he was a successful screenwriter before the war, it's never suggested that he was like a amiable peacenik before he went away and then he came back. And the movie's stronger for that, for suggesting that the kind of roiling violence within him is core to his being and not just a pure sudden trauma visited upon him by service. But still, I just couldn't help thinking of all of that. I mean, but despite my earlier comment about him being a violent weirdo, of course, this is incredibly compelling. Their love interlude before she begins to fear him is incredibly wonderfully rendered. And I can completely understand why this is one of your all-time faves. But I'd love to hear more from you, Dana, about what particularly you love about it and how it earned its place in your all-time pantheon.
I mean, I think a huge part of it I can't really get into without spoiling a lot of stuff. And like I say, not just the ending, but, you know, some of the twists along the way is just that, you know, strip aside all of the noir trappings and, you know, the fantastic music by George Antheil, who was this kind of avant-garde and classical composer who just writes these beautiful love themes. If you strip away everything, the craft of it, it comes down to this love story between two people who absolutely cannot make it work and absolutely want to and should be able to. You know, there's this sense almost that meeting Laurel Gray, the neighbor who gives him an alibi to get out of this murder, is what Dick sees as his shot at salvation, at becoming maybe a good person and not the twisted and lonely and withdrawn person that we meet him as at the beginning of the film. And she believes in that myth too. And I feel like anybody who's ever had a relationship where they were trying to save someone, whether that person was a violent character or not, but a relationship where you think our love will somehow save us and redeem us, cannot watch this movie without being heartbroken, because you want that so much for the both of them. The chemistry between them is incredible. The humor between them is great. I mean, it's just so economically rendered. You absolutely believe in them and root for them and don't want him to be the killer. And then what you learn about, you know, about both of them over the course of the movie just absolutely breaks your heart. I mean, I feel like I'm just saying the same thing over and over. You just you have to see it in order to get what I'm talking about. But I feel like there aren't that many romances, particularly of this time, that give the woman as much agency — is sort of the wrong word because she's kind of a masochist — but as much psychological attention as Laurel Gray's character gets in this. And there are very few romances from this time that don't either end with a sort of happy domestic ending of, you know, we're going to move in together and make babies, or an ending where, you know, one of the two lovers turns out to be unworthy and therefore rejected by the other and by the audience. And I feel like this movie walks that line so delicately at the end.
Yeah, I think, Dana, that is really the key. The ending, which I don't want to give anything away, is really, I mean, it's as close to a full-on tragic ending as in the really original sense of that term as I can remember a Hollywood movie from that era offering up the audience. One thing I just want to point to one more time is, you know, Bogart had such a tortured relationship to his craft and to his celebrity. He was a really interesting, literate, intelligent, and legitimately tormented human being who thought he had let himself down by becoming an actor. And that's what made him a great one. All of that spite, internalized spite and ambivalence, rises to the surface in his best performances. And the writer Louise Brooks, I think, really captured it and said this was the best one. And I just want to read what she wrote. She said, "Before inertia set in, Bogart played one fascinatingly complex character, craftily directed by Nicholas Ray, in a film whose title perfectly defined Humphrey's own isolation among people in a lonely place gave him a role that he could play with complexity, because the character's pride in his art, his selfishness, his drunkenness, his lack of energy, stabbed with lightning strokes of violence, were shared equally by the real Bogart." And he's magnificent. They're both magnificent in the movie, absolutely. But of his movies, arguably, I think this is his best performance. It's It's really weird and upsetting because he's frightening in the movie. He's legitimately frightening, and he's frightening for what he does. He's frightening for what you suspect he may have done, even if he's innocent of this murder. He's intolerable, but very magnetic. And that just draws your eyes to the screen and pulls you along the plot as a suspense plot.
Yeah, I'm so glad you read that Louise Brooks quote. If anybody wants to track down where it came from, it's in this great essay called Humphrey and Bogey that Louise Brooks wrote that's collected in her book Lulu in Hollywood. And I mean, as wonderful as she was as a silent actress, Louise Brooks is just as good as a writer about Hollywood. And I really recommend that book Lulu in Hollywood that quote comes from. I had brought something in to read too, which is something that Nick Ray said when giving a film class many years later, in which he mentions Bogart's performance and what was so special about it in this movie, how connected it was in a way to his own psychology and his own character. It's him talking to an acting student who describes a moment in which he got scared in a scene, essentially because he sort of lost emotional control. And Nick Ray says, "What happened to you was a beautiful example of the involuntary performance, although a performance can never be completely involuntary because there's always at least the willingness to appear. After an involuntary performance, the actor is kind of stunned and bewildered. He doesn't know what happened to him. He is in shock at having caught sight of his own evasions, tricks, and cliches, or at sensing something of his own vast and untapped resources, or of being forced to answer the question of why he became an actor at all." And then the interview asks, can you give some examples from your films? And he mentions a few different things, including Salminio and Rebel Without a Cause. But then he says, "The scene at Romanoff's bar and In a Lonely Place," which you'll remember is that late scene where, you know, Bogart is completely losing control. And the scene of Gloria and Bogey in the kitchen, he says, which is that wonderful scene often included in anthologies of noir films of the grapefruit when he comes to her apartment and fixes her a grapefruit as she's just waking up. And there's a reason, I think, that Bogart character taps so deeply into the real Humphrey Bogart, which is that he and Nicholas Ray made this film together with Bogart's production company. So they sort of went outside the studio system, created this small production company. They had already made one film together in it called Knock on Any Door a couple years earlier and, you know, decided to return to this small independent production company to work together. In fact, that's why Lauren Bacall is not in the movie. That was who Bogart wanted, his own wife, to play the Laurel Gray character, but her studio was unwilling to loan her out to this independent company. So they found Gloria Graham, and I cannot imagine anyone being better than her in the role.
She's incredible, and it would not be a Dana and Julia Talk About Film segment if I didn't very briefly note that I would like to own every single thing she wears in the entire movie. I have like never, except for maybe... I also felt this way about the clothes that Emma Thompson wore in Late Night, that Mindy Kaling comedy last year, but I have like never seen a more covetable wardrobe than Gloria Graham's in this. So
yeah, and the wardrobe, you know, communicates her character so perfectly. Just what she wears when she first walks into the police detective's office, and there's something about the casual, almost androgynous way that she's dressed. You just know that she's independent, that she's solitary, that she's the right woman for Dix. It's just all clear in what she wears and the way she walks.
Absolutely.
All right, superb. Well, the movie is In a Lonely Place, starring Humphrey Bogart, Gloria Graham. It's directed by Nicholas Ray. You got to check it out. You got to check. I mean, this is such a... One more thing I will say, Dana, I think you'll agree with me. This is a classic of the example of a weird Freudian Hollywood oddball from the golden age that didn't do a lot of business when it first came out, but the young Frenchies at Cahiers du Cinéma, Godard and Truffaut among them, worshipped Nicholas Ray, worshipped this movie, and put it really seriously back on the map as the Bogart classic. It is such that movie of the, it was too weird for America, it was too weird for 1950, but in the 1960s, you know, Nouvelle Vague critics who were reinventing cinema, you know, championed it to great effect. It is almost the perfect example of that movie.
Yeah, I would agree. If you want to understand the Cahiers crowd and what it was about low-budget film noir that they seized onto and found sort of the highest expression of le cinéma américain, you got to watch In a Lonely Place.
Yeah, hear, hear. All right, anyway, check it out. Let us know what you think of it.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
I think you guys know what I'm going to endorse because we talked about doing it as a segment this week, and I think it would have been a good one. But at the very least, I hope that I can send people to it, and that is the short film, very short, 3.5 minute long film that Spike Lee made last week and released online, which I'm sort of amazed didn't go wildly viral because I really thought it was like the best, maybe the best film that Spike Lee has made yet in the 21st century. And maybe that's just because it hit me and, you know, hit the world at this very vulnerable moment. But it's just basically a music video. It's Frank Sinatra's version of New York, New York, you know, that iconic version that's played after every Yankees game, etc. And Spike Lee just went around. He must have just gotten a car and a Super 8 camera and driven around New York and filmed all kinds of different, some famous landmarks, some just streets in the rain, empty places that we're used to seeing full. And over the course of this 3.5 minute movie, I mean, I'm sure I'm going to get teary talking about this because I've watched it several times and cried every time. But over the course of this movie, he just very slowly reveals the crisis within the city. So at first you're seeing empty streets, but then you start to see why they're empty. You know, you see a sign on a locked park saying that it's locked because of COVID-19. You see the USS Comfort, the ship, that hospital ship that's been parked in the harbor. You start to see essential workers, but it all unfolds in this very cinematic sort of Spike Lee way. And there's a couple just thrilling transitions and dissolves in it that I won't reveal. You just have to see them for yourself. But it's such an example of, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, and this great filmmaker just having a shoestring idea that he had to execute essentially alone under a quarantine and deliver this kind of Valentine to the city. And by the end of this movie, I was just completely in tears, and I feel so grateful to him for making it. So we'll put a link to that on the show page, but you can also easily just Google Spike Lee quarantine movie. I'm sure it'll come right up.
Oh, marvelous. Julia, what do you have?
I'm going to endorse an experience I had this past weekend, which was going to the Donut Hole in La Puente, California, which is a classic of California vernacular architecture. It is a drive-through donut shop in which you literally drive through a donut, like a donut-shaped tunnel with sort of a donut on one end and a donut at the other. And as you go through on one side, they make the donuts and you can see them pulling donuts from, you know, heaping oil and put daubing frosting and sprinkles on them. And then on the other side, they sell the donuts at two counters, one for drive-through and one for walk-up. And, you know, it's still in operation. They're working with social distancing and everyone's wearing masks and gloves. And, you know, it was a adventure we took the kids on this weekend in an effort to make each weekend feel different in some way from the last. And the donuts were delicious and highly recommendable, particularly the apple fritter. But mostly, it's just really fun to drive through a gigantic donut that says the Donut Hole. And then the motto is, quote, "It's the quality," which it is the quality, but really it's that you're driving through a giant donut. So I love the motto on the Donut Hole.
They couldn't fit that on the awning. It's the fact you're driving through a giant donut.
I mean, that's, they so could good, because the awning isn't an awning. It's an enormous giant donut. Anyway, it was a classic experience, and it's one that I learned about from a piece that Carolina Miranda wrote for the LA Times this week about how drive-ins and drive-throughs, which are kind of classic LA experiences of an era of unquestioned sprawl and which had been coming in for criticism and regulation in the past few years as people are beginning to look at the benefits of density, and the problem with designing everything for cars are suddenly super useful because it's a place where you can have a semi-normal experience in a way that is pandemically relatively low risk. So I recommend both The Donut Hole in La Puente and Carolina Miranda's piece, Drive-Thrus and Drive-Ins Were Fading, Coronavirus Made Them a Lifeline, which is accompanied by just gorgeous pictures of all of these different wonderful drive-through establishments in Southern California by our photographer, Jacqueline Denon. So we'll have links to both of those on the show page.
Well, every restaurant should be shaped like the food that you're going to eat there. It's just, it's such a great LA thing to just walk into a hamburger or a donut. But if you think about it, only foods with holes in them are suited to be drive-thrus. We're pretty much limited to donuts and bagels.
All right. So our plus guest, Jody Rosen, sent me this link to a Nick Lowe doing What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding from his house for Rolling Stone magazine, a series they're doing on YouTube, you know, featuring rock stars recording a song from home. It's wonderful. I mean, Nick Lowe has, you know, he of Rock Pile, a wonderful solo career, Cruel to Be Kind, produced the early Elvis Costello records, and wrote the song What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding that Elvis Costello made famous. Nick Lowe has just turned into the great English gentleman, comfortable in his own skin, rocker of British rock and roll. I mean, he's such an elder statesman. He's so soothing. He's such a wonderful craftsman. He's aged beautifully. And I found this song, I think it's part of that same, I think he does two or three songs. I'll try to find the link, but I discovered a song of his that I didn't know called I Read a Lot. Do you guys know that song?
No.
It is perfection. And it's just that effortless wit and concision and craft that Lowe brought to songwriting, but it's a late song of his. I mean, he wrote it, I think, within the last 10 years. It's late period Nick Lowe, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful melody over these jazzy chords. And just, it is just such a wonderful song. And I think he does it as part of that At Home series, but if not, there are plenty, you know, clips of him doing it live. But anyway, we'll link to it. And then we had a listener write in talking about Andrew Bird, his love of Andrew Bird, the songwriter, musician. And that segued into saying, have you heard of Madison Cunningham, a young woman who's, you know, kind of in the Phoebe Bridgers mold, obviously listened to a lot of Joni Mitchell growing up. And she's terrific. She's incredibly talented, has not broken very big yet, but the song Dry as Sand would be a good one maybe to start with. So Nick Lowe, I Read a Lot, and Dry as Sand by Madison Cunningham. We'll link to both of them. All right. Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks, Julia.
Thanks, guys.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. Please email us. We enjoy it a lot, especially under current conditions. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com. We have a Twitter feed. It's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Our production assistant is Rachel Allen. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.